Today I'd like to start with a story. The story of the hummingbird. You know, hummingbirds are those tiny birds that we see in American movies. They go from flower to flower with their wings flapping so fast that you can't even see them. It sounds like this. Anyway, I asked the best storyteller I know to tell us this story as an intro to the show. Her name is Kate Hammer. She's a commercial storyteller, and this is the story of the hummingbird.
One day a terrible fire broke out in a forest. A huge woodlands was suddenly engulfed by a raging wildfire. Frightened, all the animals fled their homes and ran out of the forest. As they came to the edge of a stream, they stopped to watch the fire, and they were feeling very discouraged and powerless. They were all bemoaning the destruction of their homes. Every one of them thought there was nothing they could do about the fire, except for one little hummingbird. This particular hummingbird decided it would do something. It swooped into the stream and picked up a few drops of water and went into the forest and put them on the fire. Then it went back to the stream and did it again. And it kept going back again and again and again. All the other animals watched in disbelief. Some tried to discourage the hummingbird with comments like, "Don't bother, it's too much. You are too little, your wings will burn. Your beak is too tiny. It's only a drop, you can't put out this fire." And as the animals stood around disparaging the little bird's efforts, the bird noticed how hopeless and forlorn they looked. Then one of the animals shouted out and challenged the hummingbird in a mocking voice, "What do you think you're doing?" And the hummingbird, without wasting time or losing a beat, looked back and said, "I'm doing my share. What are you doing?"
This episode is about doing your share, doing what you can. As an investor, as a policymaker, as an asset owner or manager, whoever you are, there is something you can do. It could be as simple as passing along this series about climate and finance to the right people, or other resources we feature on the episode page. There is a good number of organizations working very hard all year long on those issues. We can help them. Like an army of hummingbirds. All right, let's get into the show. And you'd better stay until the end, because we're also talking about the Oscars and a movie you should watch. Oh, and if you're joining us just now, you may want to rewind a little bit. In episode 1, we've talked about the problem and how capital affects climate change. In episode 2, we reviewed what institutional investment should look like and how the system can help. Now it's time to discuss how to get there. This is The Green Exchange, episode 3 of our series on climate and finance, investors and the power to solve climate change. Let's start by reviewing how much money we need to solve climate change. There's a great chart in the Global Climate Index 2015, produced by the organization AODP, and it says, yes, it's going to be expensive, $10 trillion, but the capital is there.
Where's the money?
Well, sovereign wealth funds. Those are the state-owned investment funds. $10 trillion. Insurance companies. $28 trillion of assets. Pension funds, that's $37 trillion of assets worldwide. And then you have foundations and endowments that add a little bit more. So $10 trillion needed, and roughly $76 trillion of investments are out there today. Good news. But here comes the painful fact. Only 2% of those assets are going to low carbon investments today. Come on guys, let's get serious. What are we waiting for? A cricket invasion? Sean Kidney, co-founder and CEO of the Climate Bonds Initiative, an investor-focused not-for-profit organization based in London. Hello, Sean.
Hey, Camille. How's that audio quality?
It's good enough. Most important is what you're about to tell us, right?
Indeed.
So we were saying that we have the capital to solve climate change.
We know that we have the capital. We have a world awash in capital at the moment. We're paying negative interest rates in multiple countries because there's a lack of deal flow to give some yield for pension funds and insurance funds, who are the ones that own most of the capital, or manage, I should say, on our behalves, most of that capital. We also know, getting into more interesting territory, that much of what has to be done, in fact, by far the majority, can be characterized, according to the National Energy Agency, as infrastructure: energy, mobility, water, urban fabric. These are things where we have plenty of models available to us to make them financially viable in a way that they will and successfully attract private capital.
Okay, so we need to attract private capital. That's the key here.
In fact, to be frank, it's what we've been doing for 150 years in Western societies to build infrastructure, cities, urban fabric. These are things like guarantees, floor price guarantees for tollways. They might be 20-year agreed purchase agreements for energy, which is what drove the growth of the stable electricity market in the USA. They might be legislation.
Yeah.
Actually have a whole big toolkit of things that we've been successfully applying in the last 150 years in Europe, in the USA, in Japan, for that matter, and in China more recently. That's where opportunities lie. All we simply need to do is shift those toolkits to refocus them on green. In other words, it's making choices about policy priority infrastructure required for countries. That's essentially what it's about. And then using the same toolkit to drive down the cost of capital for those investments to make them more viable. When you're building a 100-year piece of infrastructure, the cost of capital is way, way, way the biggest expenditure item.
Okay, I pause for a second. What Sean is explaining here is that we must attract private capital to finance this transition towards a green future. And to do so, we have at our disposal a range of tools that we've been using for over a century. And that with these tools, we can drive down the cost of capital, which is generally the main barrier to long-term infrastructure development. You're following?
That's important, because we'll only meet this challenge if the private sector helps lead the way.
Do you recognize this sweet voice? That's Barack Obama, of course. He was addressing the American people on clean energy investments earlier in February.
Help the private sector create more jobs faster, lower the cost of clean energy faster, and help clean, renewable power outcompete dirty fuels in every state.
Dirty fuels? What is he talking about here? Yeah, okay, that's a politician's speech to the people. But this is music to our ears. And we've seen it earlier. Governments and policymakers play a vital role in enabling this transition. That's our first chapter for today. What are most important actions public sector needs to take in the coming years so we can stay under the 2 degrees global warming of the climate system? So let's go all the way to the top at the national level in Sweden this time.
I guess you would like to speak to the minister.
Yes, please.
Perfect. I'll give the phone to him. Just a sec.
We're going to play a few interesting pieces from my interview with Per Bolund. He is the Minister for Financial Markets and Consumer Affairs.
And also the Deputy Finance Minister of Sweden.
Sweden seems to be quite progressive on that front. Let's see what's cooking.
The first thing we did was to introduce a new target for the finance policy sector. So in the budget, we have stated that the finance sector should contribute to a sustainable development. And that comes not least on the climate issue. And this, of course, will guide the authorities working in this area within Sweden. And they will know now how to focus also on the climate and sustainability aspects of the financial sector.
So, setting targets for the financial sector's contribution to sustainable development.
We have a committee working at the moment looking into how we can improve information around climate aspects and sustainability aspects, because we see that lots of investors and people saving for their retirement, for example, want to make an impact. They want to invest in a way that produces sustainable development, but they don't have the information and the knowledge they need in order to really pull that through.
Back to disclosure and transparency across the whole investment decision chain. We've talked about this, huh? Governments can play a role in enabling this transparency.
I mean, it's easy for banks and financial institutions to just swarm you with information in such an amount that it's impossible to get access to. So you have to find indicators and you have to find measurements that you can actually access and understand.
I also asked him about the way the government's money is invested.
A lot we can do there. And of course, the first thing that is important is that we have to put our money where our mouth is. So if we are claiming to redirect Sweden into a sustainable society, we also have to invest the government's money in the same manner. So we're working very hard with the pension funds that are public in Sweden and seeing to it that they are working with sustainable investments and decreasing their footprints. And we are at the moment working on a new agenda where we are trying to raise the bar that they have to do even more. And they've led the development in a very positive way, but I think that there's still more to be done. And for example, all the AP funds together have done carbon footprint analysis, and they also have a common framework on how to disclose it. So I think that's a very good start. But now they also have to move away from fossil-heavy investments, and that's the next step. Then we're also working on for example, using green bond within the national accounting system, and whether Sweden could be a driver for issuing green bonds from the government side, either through government companies or from the government directly.
Green bonds. Let's talk about this. Remember the toolkit that Sean Kidney was talking about earlier?
The green bonds market is what's called a discovery tool.
Before getting into detail, for those of you who are not clear with how green bonds work, well, actually, let's start with regular bonds. BOND, spelled like James Bond. You can think of it as loans, but you serve as the bank. When you purchase a bond, you loan your money to a company, to a city, or to the government, and they promise to pay you back in full with regular interest payments during the lifetime of the bond. Say a city wants to build a bridge, well, they may sell bonds to raise money for that bridge. So as an investor, by buying those bonds, you are contributing to the financing of the bridge. One important feature is that many corporate and government bonds are traded either publicly on exchanges or over the counter, as we say. Climate bonds now, or green bonds, they are issued in order to raise finance for climate change solutions, right? Climate change mitigation or adaptation related projects or programs. So back to our green bond market.
The green bonds market is what's called a discovery tool. It makes it really easy for people to invest in a green bond without having to do too much due diligence if they want to invest. Luckily, we have a lot of investors who want to invest, some $43 trillion globally, who who are interested in green investments and green bonds, subject to lots of, you know, issues around risk and yield and all those sorts of things. But if they can, on balance, switch from non-green to green, they will do it. And so the labeling just makes it quickly and easy for them to do it.
So Schoen's mission with the Climate Bond Initiative is to mobilize the $100 trillion bond market for climate change solutions.
We've also been getting governments excited about what they can do, because this is clear evidence of investor demand. It's no longer abstract. Investors are buying this stuff, and all these bonds are oversubscribed 4 times or thereabouts. So that makes it an interesting story to take to governments. I say this because in a rapid economic change scenario like the one we have to pursue to address climate change, you have to have governments who are willing to act in aggressive fashions. And there's no way that the green bond market, with its private companies involved in doing it, is going to shift economies in its own right. It can help, but what it can do is help open up new avenues for governments to act when they're otherwise stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hooking to that previous discussion about who should do what between governments setting the roadmaps and investors shifting their focus.
Well, it's not so much that we need governments to support the roadmap. We need governments to get on their horses and start doing some infrastructure planning, specifically green infrastructure planning. There's a sort of global shortage of deals. And most of the deals have to be generated by governments because, you know, if you think about land appropriation, zoning, licenses, all of these things that governments do. And then the private sector can build once there's a frame in place.
Yeah, okay.
Back to that toolkit. So while there's a toolkit of financial instruments you can use, like credit enhancements and guarantees, the first toolkit is actually planning. Because if you're building a railway, someone's got to sort out the land issues. Someone has to design the urban islands that will grow up around stations that you build the railway in. In fact, someone has to figure out how to capture that land value increase to pay for the railway, because a railway is not, frankly, very viable. It's a 100-year asset that you've got to pay back in 20 years. You can't make the summer's work out of passenger revenues. You have to have other models, like MTR does in Hong Kong and Shenzhen, where they build skyscrapers around the station, and they are a property developer that happens to also build a subway. So in each of these areas, we've got to look at financial viability. We have to look at how you structure it to ensure it gets a return. And, you know, we're still managed broadly by the government, and making sure that we're very, very ambitious in each of those sectors. I think that's a challenge for Europe at the moment.
Interesting. So an important starting point for raising finance for climate solutions is public sector planning. That's another thing we can take away here.
Standing in the cold gray dawn, watching cars go.
Okay, let's close the chapter about government's role for now. We may add a few comments moving forward, but I want to get to the core of the discussion about how do we get institutional investors to shift towards climate science-based strategies, starting from disclosure and transparency.
Well, measuring is definitely not the end of the story. Once you measure, the real question is, what do you do with that information? Do you actually start to take action? And the PDC is then the second step.
You remember Eric Usher from the UNEP Finance Initiative? We've talked to him in episode 2. The PDC he's talking about here is an initiative that he is hosting. PDC means Portfolio Decarbonization Coalition. And their mission is to mobilize a critical mass of institutional investors and have them gradually decarbonize their portfolios. The first step is generating the information by measuring and disclosing the carbon intensity of their portfolios. And then
the PDC is targeting the next step, which is what we term more as the leadership approach. So it's not status quo in the industry. It's really the investors who are taking the next step. And how they start to decarbonize is very open territory, I'd say, today. It's very early days. And you'll notice that we say decarbonize and not specifically divestment.
Let's talk about divestment for a second. Is that the kind of actions we're looking for?
We're absolutely agnostic on the issue of divestment. It's great for those who are able to do it. But many in the mainstream investment community, for various structural and other reasons, it's a bit hard for them to fully divest today. Now, and it depends from what. I think certainly one of the turning points in 2015 was divesting from coal no longer seems unreasonable for the mainstream. I think we hope that big steps forward, and there were a lot of announcements around Paris in that direction. Divestment from other part of the fossil or other parts of the economy gets a bit more complicated. We realize that there are a lot more work needs to be done on different types of approaches.
So this action side of decarbonization seems to capture a very broad set of activities, right?
Precisely. It can consist of full divestment from specific sectors, from other types of portfolio reconstruction. So you're juggling your portfolio in a way, for instance, I mentioned earlier, of moving towards best in class within specific sectors. Or very importantly, it can involve engagement. So rather than selling the stock and no longer having any influence over it, it means working with the company to try to have your leverage as an investor towards influencing a strategy which is more aligned with reducing emissions.
That's another key takeaway for us. Decarbonizing your portfolio can consist of full divestment from specific sectors. We don't see this that often. Number two, reconstructing your portfolio by moving towards best-in-class investments in specific sectors. And number three, engagement. In other words, how do you use your influence on the companies to help them shift their focus? And again, you may be doing this because you're a kumbaya, yippee, I'm a tree hugger kind of investor, or maybe because it's your duty. Let's learn a new word, fiduciary duty. Well, actually, let's also learn how to pronounce it.
Fiduciary. Fiduciary.
Fiduciary. Fiduciary.
Fiduciary.
Fiduciary. Fiduciary duty is a legal duty to act solely in another party's interests. Parties owing this duty are called fiduciaries.
Fiduciary.
Someone we didn't manage to have on the phone is Nathan Fabian, who is the Director of Policy and Research at the well-known UN Principles of Responsible Investing, PRI. Since we couldn't reach him in time, I'm going to play a segment from a very interesting discussion that took place during the COP21 at the Caring for Climate Business Forum. in a panel where, by the way, there was six women and Nathan was the token man. It's not often enough that we see that kind of mix. This discussion is interesting because it talks about some of the legal aspects. I'm sure they won't mind if we listen to it altogether.
There are two duties that are relevant to investors, that of loyalty and that of prudence. When we are being loyal, we are acting in the interests of our beneficiaries. And as that happens, that's all of you, through your pension funds and your individual investments. When we are acting with prudence, we're acting with due care, skill, and diligence. And through our research program, we found that because ESG, or environmental, social, and corporate governance issues, can be material, there is in fact an obligation to prudently incorporate them into investment practice.
What that means is that you must demonstrate due care, skill, and diligence in the way you consider climate change.
No longer is it acceptable to get your information from popular newspapers. You must in fact get your information from expert scientific opinion, from properly performed economic analysis, and informed financial analysts. You must stress test your portfolios to consider climate risks. You must require 2 degree or less than 2 degree of warming business plans from the companies you invest in. And if you do not, you must ask how you will mitigate any risks that might arise from these companies not making the transition to an economy with less than 2 degrees of warming.
This is a landmark development in the understanding of fiduciary duties and a clear step forward from where we were 10 or 15 years ago.
So Nathan, that all sounds fine, but I chair it's a small by global standards, but you know, a few hundred million pound charity endowment.
This is Mr. David Pitt Watson, co-chair of UNEP-FI, and he was moderating the panel.
We're maybe invested in 5,000 companies. What's my fiduciary duty?
Your duty, if you use an external funds manager to invest for you, is to have a process for ensuring that they assess each of those 5,000 companies.
And you would say that's what the law says?
The law will say that you must demonstrate diligence and prudence in your process. Now, that means understanding if the companies you invest in have a high exposure either to climate risks or to emissions. And so someone in your investment supply chain has to know the answer. It's not good enough for you to say, we've got 5,000 companies, it's too hard for us to know the answer. That's the difference.
Okay, so I need to do that because if I don't... This sounds a silly question. I need to know that because if I don't, I destroy the planet. Or I need to know that because if I destroy the planet, then my endowment's not going to be worth very much.
The latter.
And good transition here. I'm wondering, what is the level of awareness on this? Do investors realize that decarbonizing is just proper risk management? Is there any material reasons to decarbonize your portfolio?
I don't know.
I ask Eric Usher.
Obviously, every investor has their own perspective. Certainly, there's the two sides. It's is it regulatory action which is going to impair your assets, or is it the actual climate risks that you might be running? And as Mark Carney likes to talk about, the transition risks, essentially, that certain industries will quite quickly become devalued as market sentiment turns against them.
Then I asked Julian Poulter from the Asset Owners Disclosure Project. We've talked to him in episode 2 as well. You remember, right? Okay. Let's make sure we're focused here. All this is very important. We're asking the question, is there any material reasons to decarbonize your portfolio?
The attributes of climate change as a financial risk are unique. And here's the reason why, and this is very important to understand. When investors look at the long term, things like geopolitical risks and social economic risks and so forth, there's a lot of vagueness about how a very lack of precision about how they can view such risks. because we're not sure how technology is precisely going to impact our life and whether or not we'll all be driving around in driverless cars within 5 years or 25 years, where medicine will be at, how old we'll be living, all of these things, and where the big security risks are. But when it comes to climate change, with almost 100% certainty, we know that it's happening. We know that it's going to be high impact, but it's also going to be long term. And so we know with reasonable precision also that there is going to be some, even though not to a geographical accuracy, but we know there's going to be more extreme weather and the types of impacts it's going to happen. So we've got these long-term, high-impact, high-certainty risks that make it very difficult for the short-term financial system to manage and understand.
Yeah, it's again this tricky balancing act between long-term impact and short-term results. And as always with change management, it's about the processes we're going to be able to deploy.
And that requires not just a change in the way that we think about the use of stock markets and so forth, but it was also a great cultural change and a human challenge within the financial system. Over the years, typically pension funds and other asset owners outsource all of their management of these sorts of risks, including long-term risks, to fund managers who invest in stock markets. Now, because of the way that the financial system has been built up, we know that stock markets are incapable of pricing the risk of climate change accurately and within a time frame that we need.
I repeat this important point from Julian here. We know that stock markets are incapable of pricing the risks of climate change and within the time frame that we need.
And I think the subprime crisis of 2008 proved once and for all that actually the people who trade in the stock market are prepared to take more risks than the pension funds as long-term investors should be comfortable with. And so the same is true now. The fund managers are still investing, strangely enough, in oil and gas, even though, of course, we happen to be in an oil price and coal price commodity crash at the moment. But they're still maintaining the faith in some of these oil and gas companies, way beyond where they should do for the type of long-term risk that climate change represents. And that's forcing these longer-term investors, like the pension funds and other asset owners, to say, well, actually, we've got to lose faith a little bit in the way that stock markets manage these sorts of risks, and we're going to have to manage them in other ways.
Okay, that's a good segue to our movie section. I'm sure you heard about the Oscars on Sunday night. And most importantly, there's a movie this year that I think you should watch. Let's start with the movie you should watch.
Michael, how are you?
I found something really interesting.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb.
It's called The Big Short. Great casting, which is probably why most people who do not care about finance still went to see it. Ryan Gosling, Brad Pitt, Steve Carell, Christian Bale. Looks great.
And I am getting madder and madder.
It's unbelievable.
Then this guy walks into my office and says,
there's some shady stuff going down.
It's about the housing market and the 2008 crisis of the subprimes. Pretty nerdy, but it's very interesting and pretty well done. It's a bit like a documentary.
I'm sure the world's banks have more incentives than greed.
So I'm at the movie theater, right, having a good time, and I look around me, and most people look disappointed. Where's Brad Pitt? Where's Brad Pitt? Oh, it's him with a beard. Okay. He's old. But I think most people are not so solid on how the US housing market works, of course. They've heard of the subprime crisis. But if you don't know what is a bond or a AAA, and you were focusing on the popcorn at the very moment they explained it, you're basically screwed for the rest of the movie.
The banks got greedy, and we can profit off of their stupidity.
You want to bet against the banks?
I think we're either high or having a stroke.
Anyway, the story in a few words. Four people in the world of high finance predict the credit and housing bubble collapse of 2007-2008 and decide to take on the big banks for their greed and lack of foresight. Basically, those guys saw it coming.
Fraud has never ever worked. Eventually, things go south. When the hell did we forget all that?
So why are we talking about this movie? Well, there is a disturbing parallel with climate finance. I had a great discussion with Julian about this.
I got in the climate change business in late 2006, which was perfect timing. And I've made the study of the subprime crisis a hobby of mine. I can tell you it is a precise parallel. The build-up of carbon risk in the economy is in many ways a precise parallel to what The Big Short is trying to show. And it's an excellent movie. And indeed, actually, there are people out there like Michael Burry and Steve Eisman, who were there back in 2007, who are already shorting the high carbon economy.
Shorting is basically a strategy used when you want to profit from the decrease of the price of a stock.
It's just that there hasn't yet happened in such scale that has made the sort of impact that we need. But in terms of the way that, for example, ratings agencies have failed to reprice high carbon debt in the same way they failed to price the risks of collateral debt obligations and credit default swaps. And these are systemic failures. And if you look at if any of your listeners have got a few hours to read, go back to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission reports, and you'll see a precise series of concerns that are being repeated over climate change.
Well, I hope that this is enough to take you to see the movie. Remember that our primary mission at the Green Exchange is to fish for international knowledge and inspiration so we can contextualize and advance our green agenda here in the region. Thank you to WWF for making this series on climate and finance possible. It's because of their support that this special edition is accessible to everyone and not only to subscribers. You know it, the Green Exchange Plus makes your life easier as a sustainability professional and will help you make the right decisions this year. So check how it works on our webpage, www.greenexchange.se, and we're preparing a number of exciting new features. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is GreenXOsund, Facebook at The Green Exchange. Before we finish with the Oscars, a quick recap of the key takeaways for this episode. There is enough capital out there to finance the transition of a climate-friendly society. A lot of this capital is private. And in order to harness it, governments need to act as enablers of this transition. So this capital can be directed towards sustainable development by setting targets, by driving ambitious planning, by clarifying how to carbon footprint, etc. Transparency of the portfolios is an important first step so we can access information. But asset owners need to take significant actions to decarbonize them, either by divesting from specific sectors, by reallocating assets, or via engagement strategies. It is your duty as an asset owner. There are recent interpretations of the law that could make this a driver as well. The carbon pricing issue, even if we're still waiting for a direct price on carbon, as an investor, don't wait to shadow carbon price your assets so your company valuations are more accurate. You'll be in a much better shape when the storm will come. And it will come. So it's not about waiting for the tools or for the others to do something. We have all we need. It's about looking at the evidence, looking at the benefits, and being responsible, doing the right thing. It's also about having the hummingbird's mindset, as always. We're going to start publishing bonus materials on social media with pieces of interviews we could not include in the talk show. So you'd better click that like button if you don't want to miss out.
You know what else I miss? Pizza.
And I invite you to check our complimentary resources section, where you can find the Global Climate Index 2015, produced by AODP. Very good stuff. Resources around the Portfolio Decarbonization Coalition as well. And we invite you all to share with us cases and stories, because we're going to keep spreading the word about successful efforts via our Facebook and Twitter. I would like to give a big thank you to all the people who supported the Climate and Finance series. You know who you are. It's been a very interesting journey, and it's definitely not over. We'll be following up and praising the efforts of all the hummingbirds out there. One hummingbird who is definitely doing his share is Mr. DiCaprio, a big advocate of sustainable development. And I wanted to end this episode with a speech he gave after finally winning the Oscar for Best Actor. It was quite moving, and I'm sure you'll agree with him. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon for more green knowledge and inspiration. We have a lot to cover this year. Keep up the good work in the meantime.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
This is the first Oscar and sixth nomination for Leonardo DiCaprio.
Thank you. Thank you all so very much. Thank you to the Academy. Thank you to all of you in this room. I have to congratulate the other incredible nominees this year for their unbelievable performances. The Revenant was a product of the tireless efforts of an unbelievable cast and crew I got to work alongside. First off, to my brother in this endeavor, Mr. Tom Hardy. Tom. Your fierce talent on screen can only be surpassed by your friendship off screen. To Mr. Alejandro Iñárritu, as the history of cinema unfolds, you have forged your way into history these past 2 years. What an unbelievable talent you are. Thank you to you and Chivo for creating a transcendent cinematic experience for all of us. Thank you to everybody at Fox and New Regency, in particular Arnon Milchan. You were the champion of this endeavor. My entire team. I have to thank everyone from the very onset of my career, Mr. Caton Jones, for casting me in my first film, Mr. Scorsese, for teaching me so much about the cinematic art form, to Mr. Rick Yorn. Thank you for helping me navigate my way through this industry, and to my parents. None of this would be possible without you. And to my friends, I love you dearly. You know who you are. And lastly, I just want to say this. Making The Revenant was about man's relationship to the natural world, a world that we collectively felt in 2015 as the hottest year in recorded history. Our production needed to move to the southern tip of this planet just to be able to find snow. Climate change is real. It is happening right now. It is the most urgent threat facing our entire species. And we need to work collectively together and stop procrastinating. We need to support leaders around the world who do not speak for the big polluters or the big corporations, but who speak for all of humanity, for the indigenous people of the world, for the billions and billions of underprivileged people who will be most affected by this, for our children's children, and for those people out there whose voices have been drowned out by the politics of greed. I thank you all for this amazing award tonight. Let us not take this planet for granted. I do not take tonight for granted. Thank you so very much.